I want you for just a second to turn back a couple of books to 2 Timothy. It goes 2 Timothy, Titus, Philemon, Hebrews. So if you just back up 4 books, you'll get to 2 Timothy chapter 2. Because I really think that the Lord tells us clearly that lust is a different breed of temptation. Some temptations are just the temptation of the moment to get angry, to get impatient, to have a touch of this or that wrong response. But lust is a simmering, deeply planted root in our life. And this is what God says in 2 Timothy 2:22. Tells us this: "Now flee from youthful lusts and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace with those who call on the Lord from a pure heart." But the beginning is so clear. Flee, run, at all costs. Leave the presence of lust when you see it starting to smolder and come to flame of passion. When you see it starting to raise its wicked head up in your life, run from it. The Lord will always make an escape route for us. Now I want you to turn back with me to the Old Testament, to 2 Samuel. Now that one's a little harder to find. 2 Samuel, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 and 2 Samuel. There you go. It's about the 9th book maybe. But 2 Samuel in the Old Testament, and we're going to start in chapter 5, because what I want to trace for you, and if you've never seen this before, I'd like to show you the 6 dreadful steps downward that the man after God's own heart took as he was enticed, baited, hooked, and rung in by lust. And his lust destroyed David's life and testimony. And it's very, very subtle and insidious how this occurred. And I want to trace the steps for you. Let me first read them to you. Because as we examine David the giant killer, we find that he was killed by the giant of lust by 6 dreadful steps down, starting in 2 Samuel chapter 5. In that chapter, we find that David, first of all, desensitized his conscience by incomplete obedience. It's kind of like the warning lights on the dashboard of his car, of his life. He put tape over them so he couldn't see them blinking at him. He disabled, as it were, and I remember in the early days when seatbelt buzzers, you know, remember when they tried to start enforcing seatbelts, and it used to be that, you know, the whole time if you didn't have your seatbelt on. And I remember finally, as a teenager, finding that part of the car that made that noise, and I pulled it out. The only thing is, they were smart. They attached to something else, my car wouldn't start. So I had to put it back in. But, you know, we try and disable those warnings in our life. And David desensitized his conscience by incomplete obedience. Now, what I want to show you in just a minute is that we do the same thing. David was a great guy. He loved the Lord. He was writing the Scripture. He was writing some of the highest forms of Scripture. He was writing worship to God. But he didn't obey God completely in his life. He was involved in socially acceptable items that were unacceptable to God. And we have the same conflict in our life. The second step downward was he relaxed his grip on personal purity. In other words, he let things slide in his life. He says, oh, that's not as important as it used to be. You know, I don't want to be prudish and Victorian and puritanical. I don't need, you know, to be that careful. Thirdly, David fixated his heart on his physical desires, and he just started thinking about his desire, and that's all he thought about. He fixated on them. Fourthly, he rationalized his mind about wrong decisions. He started saying, well, it's not that bad. It's only once. Nobody will know. He started rationalizing. We have an infinite capacity for rationalization. Fifthly, David descended his life into lustful sin, and finally he destroyed his testimony by the sin of a moment. By a moment of stolen pleasure, death, deceit, murder, immorality, spiritual oppression, spiritual poverty, and the spiritual famine of his soul were only a few of the offspring of that act of momentary pleasure that David participated in. Let's look first of all in 2 Samuel 5 and verse 13. This is a verse, if you didn't think about it very long, really doesn't sound bad at all. This is David's desensitization of his conscience by his incomplete obedience. This is the first sign of what was going to happen. This is carelessness. This is a little slight wandering. This is just a little tiny loosening in some socially acceptable areas. Verse 13 tells us that David's sin with Bathsheba was decided way back in the early days of his kingship, when David relaxed his grip on the way God asked him to live. Let me read to you verse 13. 2 Samuel 5:13. It says, "And David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem." Sounds like you're just kind of reading the news. You know, it's nothing major. It's nothing bad. It's kind of neutral. He just took some more concubines and got some more wives after he'd come from Hebron. Also, he had more sons and daughters. They were born to David. You know, so right away we say, was this really bad? I mean, wasn't everybody doing it? Didn't Abraham have multiple wives? I mean, you know, Jacob had several wives. Why, they're all God's people. Is that so bad? Was it really wrong? Didn't everybody do it back then? Yes, some of them did. But if God says something is wrong, it's wrong even if everybody does it. I want you to just look for me, with me, back in Deuteronomy. This is really getting to be Bible drill time. But turn back to Deuteronomy 17, fifth book of the Bible. This is the code that the kings were supposed to live by. It's very, very powerful. Deuteronomy 17, and I'm going to start reading in verse 15, because this contains God's instructions for his leaders. And by the way, in principle form, they're very, very much something we should heed today. If you want to be a man or woman of God, very, very powerful words. It says, verse 15, "You shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses." So don't follow anybody that God hasn't picked. "One from among your brethren." Same principle applies. You know, don't set women a leader over your life, a husband that God didn't pick for you that isn't a believer. I mean, you see, it's all tied together. This is what Paul's talking about in 2 Corinthians when he says unbelieving people are not to be dated by believers, and they're not to be courted and not to be engaged or married. You don't do that. Now you say, "Well, my friend did and they got saved." Yeah, but for everyone that gets saved, 20 don't. And they have a life of heartache. But I'm not talking about marriage this morning. Verse 16, "But he shall not multiply horses for himself." Why? Well, that would cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. Egypt was kind of like the horse breeding area of the world. And he said, if you go back to Egypt, you're going to be lured in by their gods and their false ways and their immorality and all that. So king, number one, don't multiply horses. Well, good. David sure didn't have a problem with that. As far as we know, he wasn't into horses. Verse 17, "Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away." Uh-oh. Did you know David knew this? You'll see in just a minute, he wrote these words himself on his own copy, because every king, when they became king, were to take from the priest the scroll of God, and they were to copy out for themselves a copy of God's commands. You'll see it in just a minute. So David knew this. Don't multiply wives. They are going to turn your heart away from God. "Nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself." David's personal fortune was in the billions. Billions. He left easily, $10 to $15 billion worth of gold and silver and countless amounts of iron and bronze for the temple. Now, that was all well and good. God wanted it for the temple. But David personally disobeyed God because he multiplied for himself wives and possibly multiplied for himself wealth. God says, don't do that. Verse 18, "It shall be when he sits on the throne of his kingdom." Look at this. This is what I told you. "He shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priests, the Levites." Verse 19, "And it shall be with him." He's got to carry it around with him. "He shall read it all the days of his life." Some people say, where does it say in the Bible we're supposed to read the Bible all the time? Right here. It says you're supposed to have a personal copy. You're supposed to keep it with you all the time. You're supposed to be in it, meditating on it, reading it all the days of your life. For what reason? That he may learn to fear the Lord his God. You see, a continued exposure to this book causes us to learn about God and to live a life that acknowledges our fear of him. And to be careful, verse 19 says, to observe all the words of this law and of these statutes. Why? Verse 20. So his heart isn't lifted above his brethren. So he doesn't think that he can look over the rooftop of his house and look at anybody's wife he wants and take them. That's exactly what happened. What had happened was his heart was lifted up. He says, boy, I'm the number one warrior. I'm the giant killer. I'm the wealthiest guy in the land. I'm the greatest. I'm the king of God's people. And I can have who and what and whenever I want anything. He says, don't let your heart be lifted up so you turn aside from the commandments to the right hand or to the left, that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. What was David's first step down? He personally, by choice, desensitized his conscience by disobeying God. Now, I'm not going to repeat it all, but I'll tell you that this is a constant problem today with us, God's people in the church. God has said, you and I are not strong enough to set wicked things in front of us. God says we do not set wicked things in front of our eyes. We do not look at anything that's involved with the lust for things. And that's why if we regularly drool over the magazines that show the showcases of the world, we will want to live in them and have them. If we regularly drool over the catalogs that show how the people that spend altogether too much money on their clothing dress, we will want to have those things. It is the season to get catalogs, isn't it? I mean, we get enough. I could start a recycling bin at my house for the catalogs that I'm getting. I don't know whether it's the zip code, whether it's Broken Arrow or what, but it's just we're on everybody's mailing list this year all of a sudden. Maybe it's the taxes I'm paying. I don't know. But they're just, and so they're coming. And, you know, I throw them away, but this week I thought I'd look at one that says golf. And, you know, I don't know anything about golf, so I thought I'd look at that catalog. Buy the first sweater costs more than my first car. I looked at that and I thought, if I wore that, I'd be going around like this thing. Don't get near me. Don't touch me. Don't run my sweater. It's going to get hurt. You know, $475. Well, and I looked at the pants in this catalog. Well, I won't even comment. I mean, it was just everything. I mean, it was ridiculous. But I guess if you don't even need to count your money if you have so much that you could spend it, but it doesn't matter. But if you look at that stuff long enough, after I looked at that catalog, I threw it away and then I walked in and I looked at my sweater. And the baby had spit up a little bit right there. Of course, one of the kids had, learning to take notes in church, had hit me with their pen. There's a little pen mark right there. And I looked at the label, and, you know, it said Walmart, you know, and I didn't pay $475 for it. So I started feeling a little shabby. So I froze when I met Royce this week because I didn't want to wear my old dirty sweater, you know. That's what happens in our lives. You know, you start looking at that stuff, and you start wondering, and well, we'll get into the rest later. Verse 20, don't let your heart be lifted up. Don't turn aside from the commandments to the right or the left so you can prolong your days.